Brian Lehrer on WNYC. By the way, in case you're interested, I'll be on TV tonight talking about the Supreme Court decision, the Scott Brown election, and other politics as part of the New York One Reporters Roundtable. That's around 7:30 and 10:30 tonight on New York One. Now, a banker makes in an hour what a farmer makes in a year. The real price of a hamburger might be $200. And buying things on your MasterCard costs money, but the reward? Priceless. Raj Patel is back to talk about things like this. He's the author of the new book, The Value of Nothing, which proposes a whole new way of thinking about what we value. And you might remember that he joined us the day after the earthquake hit in Haiti. In addition to being a visiting scholar at UC Berkeley Center for African Studies and a fellow at Food First, he's on the board of the Otebenga Alliance, which works toward peace and justice around the world, including in Haiti. So we'll ask him prices and values and Haiti, too. Raj Patel, welcome back to WNYC.
It's good to be back, Brian.
Tell me why you say a burger should really cost $200.
Well, this is a calculation that some researchers in India did, and they took seriously the idea that people today know the price of everything and the value of nothing. And they thought, well, all right, look, although we get our burger for $4 at the at our local burger joint, there's environmental destruction that often accompanies the growing of feed for this burger. And if for example, this burger was made from a cow that was on land that used to be rainforest, and in the 80s we heard a lot about rainforests being chopped down to so that people could have hamburgers. Well, they said, look, if we could sit down and figure out some rough dollar values of what was lost when we chopped down the rainforest, and they came up with a figure of $200 for the things that were lost, things like biodiversity, the plants and animals that were in that rainforest, the carbon that was lost, the oxygen that wasn't being produced, the services that the environment was providing that have been destroyed to be able to make this hamburger. And so that $200 is just a sort of a ballpark guess at some of the environmental cost of the hamburger, and that doesn't even include the labor costs. Our burgers are so cheap because, for example, if they're consumed in the United States and they have tomatoes in them, those tomatoes will come from southern Florida. And in southern Florida since 1997, over 1,000 people have been freed from conditions of modern slavery. Over 1,000 modern-day slaves have been freed from the tomato plantations in southern Florida. And again, those costs don't enter into the hamburger either.
Well, maybe the labor costs enter into it, low as they may be, because that's a direct cost on the producer. But I certainly hear 100% what you're saying about the environmental costs, what environmentalists call externalized costs. And that's probably not a strikingly new concept to a lot of our listeners who've thought in the abstract about something like this. But how do we get practical with it? How do we place a dollar value on vital resources like water or the rainforest?
Well, this gets to the tough question of how it is that we allow corporations to value or not value things. And it would be nice. I mean, there's an example that's sort of in the works at the moment. So let's talk about the soda tax, because the idea of a soda tax is that we see in the U.S. today that one in five of our healthcare dollars is spent taking care of someone who has diabetes. And we know from a great deal of public health research that the part of the increase in diabetes has to do with the increase in sugar in our food. And so one of the public policy proposals is for there to be a tax on sugar in soda to be able to increase the cost so that some of that cost is internalized. So some of the externality comes into the price of buying soda.
So this is exactly the right track that Governor Patterson is on, you're saying.
Well, it is, except, of course, if we compare it to something like tobacco, where we know that tobacco is linked with cancer, and we embarked on a big public health strategy, internalizing the costs was only part of it. We also embarked on an education program. We also imposed limitations on corporations' right to free speech. So, discouraged advertising of cigarettes to children, for example. And this public health strategy is something that actually goes much deeper than merely slapping a tax on things. If we're going to seriously internalize the externalities in a way that is just and fair, then we also need to think about why it is that particularly low-income populations have access, are predominantly affected with diabetes, and why it is that poor food is much easier to find in poor communities than healthy food. I mean, I have a friend here in West Oakland who's part of a group that's working to make good food available in low-income communities, and he says, look, it's easier to find, easier to get a handgun here than it is to be able to find fresh fruits and vegetables. So if we're serious about internalizing the externalities and not merely making this a tax on poor people, then we need to think much more deeply about how it is that we value things like healthcare, things like a community's right to determine where their food comes from. And ultimately, that becomes a question about democracy, not about economics.
It's really interesting because the easy way to think about obesity in America and the Western world in general is that it's a side effect of affluence. And to some degree it is, because people just have an easy time consuming more. But it's also a side effect of being poor, because bad for you food is so much cheaper at the grocery store or at the fast food restaurant than healthy food. You wrote a book on the global food crisis previously called Stuffed and Starved, and you've written about last year's food riots in Haiti. 30 years ago, Haiti produced all the rice it needed to feed the population. Now it doesn't. So make the connection, since everybody, you know, Haiti all of a sudden has everybody's attention. So let's use the teachable moment. Make the connection between the price of rice, the food riots in Haiti, the role of the U.S., and the devastation they're experiencing now. How much of this does tie together, in your opinion?
I think there's a fairly clear line, and it comes through the pushing of free markets. Now, I mean, just to give you a sense of how hunger works, in the United States in 2008, 49 million Americans went hungry. Why did they go hungry? It wasn't because there was a food shortage. There was plenty of food in the United States in 2008. But what there was in the United States was a gap between what people could afford and the price of food. And this is the freedom in free markets. And in fact, your guests in the previous segment were talking about this exactly. The free market works great if you have money. If you have money, you can buy advertising time. If you have money, you can buy food. But if you don't have money in a free market, then freedom is just another word for nothing that you can afford. And that's why families went hungry in the United States in 2008. It wasn't a shortage of food. It was because of poverty. But the trouble is that the United States has been exporting this so-called free market model around the world. And in particular, they imposed it on Haiti. And in Haiti, at the beginning of the 1980s, the majority of rice that Haiti needed could be grown in Haiti. Unfortunately, there is no such thing as a free market. What we have really is a sort of concentrated market power today. And again, this runs straight on from the last segment. And so what we have in the United States is a rice industry that's subsidized, according to the Cato Institute in some years, up to $1 billion a year. And Haitian rice farmers make pennies. When the free market was brought in and Haitian rice farmers were brought this kind of freedom, they had to compete with farmers who were getting way more than they could ever dream. And of course, Haitian rice farmers responded appropriately. I mean, firstly, they exploited the land that they were on to be able to try and make a go of it. And unfortunately, they couldn't. And so they moved to the cities where they were effectively working in sweatshops, and they continue to work in sweatshops. And it is this export of the ideology of free markets, while leaving intact the profound inequalities that make those free markets very unjust, that actually ties up both the idea that we have hunger in the United States and that that's linked with poverty here, and also the fact that through some fairly aggressive foreign policy on behalf of the United States from Presidents Reagan, Clinton, and of course Bush, that we now have a situation in Haiti that is catastrophically bad. And again, I mean, underneath it all is this idea of liberty that comes with a free market that actually turns out to be liberty only if you are rich.
Raj Patel, my guest on WNYC. His new book is called The Value of Nothing. He's also at Food First and UC Berkeley Center for African Studies and on the board of the Otebenga Alliance, which works in Haiti And here's a question, listeners. What prices do you think fail to reflect the value? He says the real cost of a hamburger, when you figure in all the cost to the world, is about $200. So what would you put on that list? What the price of what fails to reflect the actual value or cost, everything included? 212-433-WNYC, 212-433-9692. But Raj Cameron in Soho wants to push back on this idea that the real cost of a hamburger is $200. Hi, Cameron, you're on WNYC.
Hi, good morning, Brian. Yes, I have a big problem with what this gentleman is saying. I mean, a hamburger costs $4 because of, that's what the market forces say, supply and demand. You know, not to disrespect India, but I want to know, how did they come up with $200? What kind of research did they do?
Not to disrespect what?
India. I know this. He told me that's what the study was done in India. And so, I just have a big problem with someone just getting on the radio and just saying a hamburger costs $200.
Well, stay there, Cameron. And Raj, make your case a little bit more to Cameron, and then let's see if he buys it, okay?
All right, Cameron. It's a good question. And, I mean, this idea of a fair market price is very important. It is about supply and demand. But the question is, what is it that the corporations who are doing, you know, who are making these hamburgers, what is it that they actually have to pay for? Do they have to pay for the loss of biodiversity that accompanies the destruction of the rainforest? Because we can impute a dollar value to that by saying, well, you know, if you had to pay for this biodiversity in the open market, how much would you have to compensate? If you had to pay for the carbon sequestration, as indeed some of the models and some of the policy that's coming down the track will make us do, how much would that carbon sequestration cost? If we had to pay for the services that the ecosystem provides for us to be able to live, how much would we have to pay?
I'll give you another one. Don't taxpayers subsidize the corn that's used to feed the cows that hamburgers come from?
Well, yeah, there's certainly a great deal of subsidy that goes into to corn and soy as well. And in fact, most of the world's soy production ends up going into meat. And if we're talking about subsidies that taxpayers have, of course, there are also tax breaks that are given to burger corporations so that they can set up small businesses as well. And these are subsidies. And of course, you know, when we're talking about the labor that goes into the tomato as well. The companies that buy these tomatoes are saying exactly what Cameron is saying. They're saying, look, actually, this is supply and demand. It's a fair market wage. And even if the workers are paid pennies and their human rights are violated, that's just what the market does, and we shouldn't be blamed for that. And what I'm saying is, yeah, that's right. That's exactly what markets do. The supply and demand actually goes to hide the real cost of things. And if we were to do an honest accounting rather than the very dishonest and disingenuous accounting that we have at the moment, the cost would be much higher.
So who, and before we let Cameron back in to respond, who pays the other $196 for all these other effects that you're listing?
Well, I mean, in general, it is people in developing countries who are saddled with the burdens of increased levels of mortality, degraded environment, and a range of particularly environmental costs. But also we pay in terms of our healthcare. As I was saying earlier on, 1 in 5 of our healthcare dollars is spent on diabetes. We end up paying that to the insurance industry. We just don't pay it in our burgers.
All right. Cameron, how convinced are you? Are you moved at all?
Not at all. I got to say, you know, this gentleman is explaining to me that workers' rights are violated. Where? What I'm trying to say is, okay, look, most of the beef in this country is raised in Iowa, let's say, right? So where's the rainforest that's been destroyed? Where? And besides, something such as beef price is a commodity. It's, you know, you could buy and sell it on world markets. So we're in competition with the rest of the world. So someone who's destroying a rainforest somewhere is going to be at a disadvantage to somebody who's raising a cow here in Iowa. So, again, market forces, supply and demand, the greatest two forces ever. And so you're not going to convince me where somebody in somebody's rights are being violated somewhere because somebody's raising a cow. That, to me, is a foreign idea. So.
Cameron, thank you very much. Appreciate your call. You didn't get Cameron. How about that idea? You want to follow up for just a second of the competition between somebody raising meat in the rainforest in the developing world and raising it in Iowa?
Sure. I mean, it's also true that the environment is destroyed through beef production here in the United States as well, as a result of runoff, particularly from animal production in the Mississippi. There's a dead zone the size of New Jersey and growing in the Gulf of Mexico every year. Some environmental scientists are worried that actually, because of that dead zone, because of the runoff that comes from hog farms and from the meat industry, that actually we will be destroying the life in the Gulf of Mexico to the extent that it won't be able to recover. Again, you know, that's not something that the meat industry ever has to pay for. And I do take a little offense at Cameron sort of shrugging off the idea that people in conditions of slavery in Florida ought not to be taken seriously. I mean, it's a federal crime. Slavery is something that I think most people don't think is a good idea. And I think the trouble is that we've been so blinded by markets.
What was
the
slavery thing? Because that's a very strong word. Compared to, you know, underpaid and not reasonable working conditions.
Absolutely, and that's why it's so horrific that in Florida today, and the coalition of Immokalee workers in southern Florida have been campaigning against this. But since 1997, over 1,000 people have been freed from conditions of modern slavery, and the people who kept them locked up in the back of trucks, who forced them, you know, who pay them pennies a day, who charge $5 for a shower, so that for some of the workers, it is cheaper to wash your hands in bleach than it is to have a shower. The people who've been prosecuted have been prosecuted under the articles that constituted the articles of abolition in the United States. So is it slavery? Well, in every legal sense, yes, it is. It's not. It doesn't involve the Middle Passage, and it's not in that way the same. You know, the same as historical slavery. But modern day slavery, it is.
We're going to run out of time in a minute. I just want to get a couple more voices on here with other things that people think don't cost the true value of making them. Ken in Stratford, real quick, you're on WNYC.
Brian, great show. I just wanted to say, you know, everything in Walmart, most of what we consume as Americans does not reflect the actual price. A lot of what we're going through right now economically is because of, you know, that world kind of coming down around us as everyone else in the world wants to live an American lifestyle, you know, eating fast food out of, you know, disposable containers. And you know, the very fact that an American consumer consumes 40 times as much resources as someone living in India, and the people in India and China want to live that same kind of lifestyle, it's completely unsustainable. We don't pay the cost of anything. Ravi's completely correct.
Ken, I'm going to leave it there. HJS on our webpage writes, oil. U.S. taxpayers support oil dictators to keep oil prices low. David from Harlem writes, T-shirts. Cotton T-shirts certainly must have a huge impact environmentally and in terms of labor. And we'll let one more in here before we run out of time, and it is Ben in Carroll Gardens. Ben, you're on WNYC.
Hey, Brian. It's a great topic. I think that the much-touted vegetable oils in general, corn oil, even olive oil, all these kind of oils do not reflect their true price. It's not easy to get oil from a vegetable. Plus, I don't believe that humans evolved to eat oils isolated from vegetables like that. But everybody likes to put down animal fats all the time and promote vegetable oils, and that, you know, try to get oil out of a piece of corn. It's not easy. There's a lot of manufacturing, a lot of processing, not even to bring up GMO, organic, you know, monocultures versus old school agriculture, et cetera.
Ben, so, thank you very much. And Raj Patel, on your way out the door, if there was one policy that you could enact that would begin to address this as you see it, what would it be?
I would put down the policy pen, go out and start organizing, because the only way that these changes have ever been made is not through a policy enactment, but because people organize to make that change happen.
So before you get to policy, just organize around the concept of it. That's where you want to start.
Really, actually, it's organizing around human rights. It's organizing around sustainable consumption. It's organizing around environmental change.
Right.
There's a lot to do.
Raj Patel's new book is called The Value of Nothing. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Brian.
Brian Lehrer on WNYC. And if you're a foodie, do you have a role in this conversation? We will follow up in a minute with two other guests on what being a foodie means for democracy. Stay tuned.